Middle class of this country is collapsing. We have 27 million people living in poverty. We have massive wealth and income inequality. Our trade policies have cost us millions of decent jobs. The American people want to know whether we're going to have a democracy or an oligarchy as a result of Citizens United.
After the Justice or Else March and the first Democratic presidential debate, we talk about activism and economics. All that and more coming up next. Welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for October 15th, 2015, on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica's Listener Power Station for Jazz and Justice in the nation's capital. On the Ground and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activism on the streets and in the suites of power. Well, following up on Saturday's Justice or Else March and the first Democratic presidential debate, today's show will focus on activism and economics. The most clearly discernible call from Saturday's action on the mall was for African Americans, all of the 99% really, to withdraw our monetary support from the corporate machine, starting with the upcoming holidays. So we'll speak to local Black Lives Matter activist Kimon Freeman and activist Ruth Kaplan about new initiatives to create more control over our dollars and our public dollars. Then in the second half of the show, the F word, our monthly discussion about fascism and pre-fascism. This month's guest is John Jeter, former Washington Post reporter, Facebook iconoclast, and author of the book Flat Broke in the Free Market, and we'll take your calls as well. Of course, speaking of activism and economics, WPFW is in the midst of its fall membership drive, and so for this hour, On the Ground is set to raise $500 for this week's goal to keep this listener-powered community station on the air. Call 202-588-9739 or pledge online at WPFW.org to show your support for On the Ground's coverage of activism here in the belly of the beast of international and national corporate and military power. So I just need five people becoming a new sustainer or renewing a membership at only $10 a month by calling 202-588-9739 or pledge on WPFW.org. No amount is too small or too large. So as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, starting with our headlines. The Justice or Else March, marking the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March, drew tens of thousands from around the country to the National Mall on Saturday to hear dozens of speakers, including the convener, Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. The primary focus of the march was police brutality, and murders by police, and On the Ground was on the mall to speak to some of those who attended.
My name is Tangela. Right now in Detroit, our educational system has been destroyed. Our people, water is being shut off by the thousands every day. 30,000 people are about to go into foreclosure, 30,000 homes rather, which means there may be three or five people in that home. So if you got 30,000 homes in foreclosure and there's five people in there, that's 150,000 people that's out on the street. And we barely have enough shelter for 400 people in the city of Detroit. So it's just about us fighting the oppression that's going on, that's pushing down on us. We want to push back. So we got to educate our people, motivate them, energize them, so that we can have a positive impact on our lives.
My name is Antoine Pitts, but I go by Ant the Artist. And I'm from Flint, Michigan, but I live in L.A. I'm a controversial artist. I mix politics and my faith. So I came up with the concept with Donald Trump and then the Klan right behind him with two Klansmen. And I use it for symbolism. I don't think he should be president.
My name is Minister Freedom Allah. The Minister, Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, put out a call, you know, to all black men across the country to come support. So that's what I'm about. I came out here to show support, not only for the minister, but for my people. And to show my people that we could come together as a collective and that we could do something like this, you know, that we could show forth unity.
In other Black Lives Matter news, a video has just been released showing police in Savannah, Georgia, tasing a bloodied, restrained man in the testicles before his death. Sean King writes in the Daily Coast that it is now abundantly clear that Matthew Ajibade was murdered by police in Savannah. According to King, for over 10 months, police and prosecutors have concealed the video evidence of his murder by not only from the public, but from his closest friends and family members. In the video, police are seen punching and kicking the man in the face and head before restraining him and repeatedly tasing him in his genitals as the man screams. Matthew Ajibade died in his cell, strapped to his restraining chair soon after being tasered. The city's coroner ruled his death a homicide, but no one has ever been charged in his death. In the Atlanta suburb of Douglasville, Georgia, the district attorney has won indictments against 15 Confederate flag supporters on charges of making terroristic threats and participating in criminal gang activity. The move comes after a group of African-American attendees at a child's birthday party said members of the white group, which calls itself Respect the Flag, threatened them with a crowbar and other weapons and yelled racial slurs. Meanwhile, in Texas, all of the more than 170 bikers rounded up and detained following a mass gang shooting in May outside a Waco restaurant have been released. 5 months after 9 people were killed in the shooting, none of the bikers has been charged with the murders, and only 22 remain on ankle monitoring. In South Carolina, the family of unarmed African-American Walter Scott, who was shot in the back by white police officer Michael Slager in April, has settled with the city of North Charleston for $6.5 million. Officer Slager was charged with murder after video showed he shot Scott in the back as he ran away. Slager remains in jail after he was denied bail by Circuit Judge Clifton Newman, who concluded releasing Officer Slager would constitute an unreasonable danger to the community. And in one of several curveballs thrown to presidential candidate Bernie Sanders in Tuesday night's debate on CNN, he was asked first whether Black lives matter or if all lives matter.
My question for the candidates is, do Black lives matter or do all lives matter?
The question from Arthur in Des Moines is, do Black lives matter or do all lives matter? Let's put that question to Senator Sanders.
Black lives matter. And the reason those words matter is the African-American community knows that on any given day, some innocent person like Sandra Bland can get into a car, and then 3 days later, she's going to end up dead in jail. Or their kids are going to get shot. We need to combat institutional racism from top to bottom, and we need major, major reforms in a broken criminal justice system in which we have more people in jail than China. And I intend to tackle that issue to make sure that our people have education and jobs rather than jail cells.
I'm following up on our interview with Dr. Margaret Flowers last week. Doctors Without Borders is waiting for a response from the U.S. and Afghanistan to approve a formal independent investigation into the bombing of its charity hospital earlier this month. A formal request has been made to the International Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission to investigate the U.S. military airstrike in Kunduz, Afghanistan, marking the first time the commission has been activated since its inception in 1991 under the Geneva Conventions. Also in international news, decrying capitalism as a threat to life, an estimated 7,000 environmentalists, farmers, and indigenous activists from 40 countries convened in Bolivia for this weekend's World People's Conference on Climate Change, aiming to elevate the demands of social movements and developing countries in the lead-up to the upcoming United Nations-led climate talks. Quote, capitalism is Mother Earth's cancer, end quote, Bolivian President Evo Morales told the crowd. According to a translation, a declaration adopted by the gathering called for, among other things, the creation of an international tribunal with a binding legal capacity to prevent, prosecute, and punish states that pollute and cause climate change by action or omission. Compensation from wealthy countries to developing nations for climate, social, and ecological debt accumulated over time. Reclamation of the global commons and wholesale rejection of the global capitalist and colonialist systems. And in Planet News in this country, yesterday was National Day on Climate Action, and the action in D.C. drew hundreds to Franklin Square in downtown D.C.
This is Chantal James with On the Ground. This 14th of October, hundreds of activists gather in Franklin Square as part of a movement for environmental justice. There are people from all walks of life, from the very old to the very young, all have one common goal in mind, justice for the climate.
City, which is the wealthiest black county in the nation. But unfortunately, as gentrification drives people out of D.C. and into my county, environmental racism follows them. All three power plants within the D.C. area closed in recent years, and now three are proposed near my home. We're in sacrifice zone. The harmful effects of fossil fuel power plants are disproportionately felt by people of color, regardless of income levels. EPA already considers our air to be unhealthy, and we may soon have a cluster of five fossil fuel power plants and an incinerator releasing tons of toxic chemicals every day.
Corporate loving trade deals would mean many of us here and around the world will continue to live in neighborhoods with toxic pollutants, exhausted resources, and sick communities. And if we let these climate corporates do the same thing at the Paris Climate Summit this December, we'll see homes destroyed and our children's futures ruined. It's not too late to push back.
For Exxon. When Exxon goes marching out. When Exxon goes marching out. I wanna be right in that number. Yeah. When Exxon goes marching out. Oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, when the saints go
Chantal James reporting for On the Ground.
The climate action on Franklin Square was one of dozens across the country. Despite corporate media pundits rushing to announce Hillary Clinton as the winner of Tuesday's debate, Senator Bernie Sanders won the votes of all focus groups, all online polls, and raised $2 million during and after the broadcast. And that's the first of our culture and media moments for today. The other pieces of the moment are these. Growing number of cities are recognizing what has traditionally been Columbus Day as Indigenous Peoples Day instead. This year, Multnomah County in Oregon, St. Paul, Minnesota, Olympia, Washington, Traverse City, Michigan, Albuquerque, and Sandoval County, New Mexico are among the latest jurisdictions to decide to mark Indigenous Peoples Day on the same day as Columbus Day. And Fox News owner Rupert Murdoch is in the news after he posted a tweet suggesting President Obama is not a real black president and expressed support for African-American Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson, who he considered real black. But maybe the sleeper news about Murdoch is that he has just purchased the National Geographic franchise, and environmentalists are calling for the board of National Geographic to hire a public editor for the media group to keep Murdoch, a climate change denier, from influencing editorial content. Petition to hire a public editor is posted at someofus.org. That's S-U-M-O-F-U-S, someofus.org. Marlon James has become the first Jamaican-born author to win the Man Booker Prize, Britain's most prestigious literary award. James won the prize for his novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings, inspired by the attempted assassination of singer Bob Marley in 1976. Beast of No Nation, a riveting movie based on the novel about a child soldier in Sierra Leone, opens in theaters tomorrow here in D.C. And finally, the campus community of the University of Texas at Austin has found a creative way to protest the fact that they soon will be allowed to carry concealed guns, but not sex toys, on school grounds. on August 24, 2016, soon after the gun law goes into effect, students and alumni will stage a campus dildo carry in which they will strap gigantic swinging dildos to their backpacks in protest of the campus gun carry law. The flyer for the action adds, "Come one dildo, come all dildos. You're carrying a gun to class? Well, yeah, I'm carrying a huge dildo." And those are our headlines and happenings. You gotta love Austin, Texas, keeping it real in the red state turning purple. When we come back, economics and activism after justice or else. I know you're glued to the radio with all this information we're dishing out, but go to the phone and show you're down with On the Ground. Call 202-588-9739 or pledge online. Just $10 a month, less than the price of one movie ticket, will help us to reach our goal. And before I go, big thanks to John in White Plains, Maryland. Thank you so much for a very generous pledge. I am halfway to my goal, and I want to thank you so much. And just thank you, thank you, thank you. 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, on pledge online at wpfw.org. We'll be right back.
STC, yeah, Universal War Veterans, travel with me, y'all, yeah, travel with me, God, let's go. Yo, I'm from the Mecca, been with true and living. Freed out G and Lord, doing time in prison. My knockers is just, I'm known to keep it true. You must be a fool to ever cross the zoo. Cadre be my crew, you know them war vets. Sack will be my set, destroying all threats. Man, I go so hard, I don't know nothing less. All I know is God and that my team the best. See me, I'm on my level, waiting for the devil. You don't want no problem, bro, I keep a shovel. My niggas on their job, ain't nothing you can tell them. It don't involve the truth and manifest in heaven. Scrooge out here collecting, I'm a living blessing. No half-stepping, homie, I keep a seven. Say what you want, hey look, I know the deal. No candy raindrops, but yo, I'm so for real, cause I be going on so hard, yes, I rep my crew. I be going on so hard, yes, I rep my crew. I be going on so hard, I be going, I'm so hard. I be going on so hard, yes, I rep some too. Yes, I be doing what I do, man, for sure.
That was the hip-hop artist Minister Freedom Allah, who traveled from Detroit to attend Saturday's Justice or Else March, where he was promoting his mixtape out on the National Mall, and so we picked one up. Well, we have talked about economics and activism at different times on the ground. After a call to boycott Black Friday last year, there was a 13% drop in sales that day. There's the Boycott Sanctions Divestment Movement, or BDS movement, designed to ostracize the apartheid state of Israel, just as South Africa was isolated and ostracized. One of the best summaries of what products not to buy are products like, you know, Sabra and Tribe Hummus. And I know you love it, but that's on the list. But one of the best summaries of the products targeted by BDS is at the website for the Bay Area Campaign to End Israeli Apartheid. And that's BACEIA.org. That's BACEIA.org. There's a campaign to boycott products like another campaign in terms of targeting the Koch brothers. And that's to target products like Brawny paper towels and I think Angel Soft tissue. And there's a good list of those products at boycottcokebrothers.com. That's boycottcokebrothers.com. And more recently, there's a really stunning feature in the New York Times about how a mere 158 American households comprise nearly half of all the money donated to the 2016 presidential campaigns thus far. So let me say that again. Just 158 American households comprise nearly half of all the money donated to the 2016 presidential campaigns thus far. These donors are disproportionately white, male, old, and very wealthy. In total, these families account for roughly $176 million in political spending, and it's not even 2016 yet. And to put that in perspective, that's almost as much money as the entire 2000 presidential campaign cost, even with inflation. So with me in the studio to talk about the Justice or Else March, money in politics here at home, control over our public dollars, is Kimon Freeman. He's a writer, Black Lives Matter activist and co-founder of the progressive We Act radio station. Good morning, Kamon.
Peace and blessings.
So, thanks for coming into the studio.
Always an honor to be with you.
Yeah. So, I know you were looking for more from the march, just seeing your comments on Facebook. And so, what did you want to see at the Justice or Else march that wasn't there?
I needed to see, first let me say that I'm a proud product of the Million Man March. I want to make that very clear. In October 16, 1995 was more than enough for a 25-year-old wayward youth to find his way. But as a 45-year-old man today, I needed a complete, concise action agenda that was going to bring ultimatum that would reach the pitch of or else to pressure a decadent system that is unresponsive to our demands for justice. I think, of course, the system is not equipped to respond to our justice. It would be a small revolution if it was to do so. Having said that, I think that what was missing was, you know, a detailed plan that was going to bring to bear our influence. There was a number of things that could have been done. One could have been simply taking our money out of said banks and moving it over here. That in itself would have been powerful, you know, because I do applaud the minister for initiating the call for boycotting Christmas, but I never celebrate Christmas anyway, so it's, you're still not speaking to me.
To some people.
Yeah,
right,
and
right.
So that we're already there, so what more can we do? There's a number of things, you know.
So I want you to talk about that. You have developed some initiatives locally, and can you talk about some of those economic initiatives?
Well, first, before I do that, I want to say what I do agree with the Brother Minister when he said that we have a climate of fear in our communities. And a lot of our listeners know what could be done to up the ante, so to speak, but they're afraid to do so. I think that is the first thing that needs to be eradicated. I lost my fear cliff diving in Jamaica, so it was no longer impervious to me. But you know, when he said that, you know, just the mere mentioning of the letters IRS, people shake and tremble. And that is very true.
Yeah.
There has been a study that showed that more people fear the IRS more than they fear God. Hmm. Okay, I want to make that clear because, you know, until we address our fear, what can we do to stand up against this decadent system? So the late, great lawyer Johnny Cochran said the best way to air your grievances against the federal government was the withholding of income taxes. What would happen if hundreds of thousands of people did that? And that's words from his mouth. It's not something I read. It's not something I heard. It's something I discussed with him personally at Union Temple. And so there's witnesses to this conversation. Because the Brother Minister doesn't pay income taxes. The Nation of Islam doesn't pay income taxes. And a whole lot of other religious institutions, like Cleflo Dollar, that some of our people are giving money to, don't pay up. But I just want to make sure that was said. But right now, we're preparing to make it known that Wells Fargo, one of the major profiteers of private prisons. There's many others, but Wells Fargo in particular, because they are the bank of choice of the D.C. government. So we're looking to force them to divest from Wells Fargo, in addition to being
for the city to divest
to the
from
city
Wells
to. Well, I also would like to see individuals do the same. I think it's a shameful that we are uneducated consumers, and we need to begin to vote with our dollars and pray with our feet. Those are the messages I wanted to hear at the march that was I feel was sorely missing. I think that people need to educate themselves on the history of Wells Fargo. In addition to being an investor in and a lender to private prisons, they also have a history of investing in apartheid South Africa. And it took movements to get them to divest from that. So we have a lot to do in terms of our short-term memory. We don't recall and connect these dots. And as they said before, follow the money, honey. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is needs to be done at this point.
So is there a structure set up right now for people to kind of join this movement? Is there a website or anything like that set up so that folks can know, you know, get more information if they want to divest?
Well, I think that first they need to be made aware of an event that's taking place next week. I think you have another guest going to be coming on talking about it. D.C. Public Banking Center is having an event next Wednesday, October 21st at 7 o'clock at the Goethe Institute. Excuse my pronunciation.
Goethe. I said the same thing.
I'm from Southeast. but 812 7th Street Northwest to educate themselves on the public banking phenomena. But yes, they need to understand who they give their money to, who they give their power to. And I haven't seen, I had this conversation with Angela Davis about economic boycotts and how it has not been utilized in our current struggles today. And because I think that's the first thing that they try to remove from the our lexicon, and because I think it's the most effective.
Okay. And as you mentioned, I have joining us by phone is Ruth Kaplan, who has organized around local, state, national, and international issues. Today, she believes that local action is where real change can take place and that public banking is a key to creating an economically just and vibrant local economy. And that's why she's campaigning to create a public bank right here in D.C. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning. Good to be with you, Esther.
So, and thank you for joining me. So what would a D.C. public bank be?
Well, first of all, a public bank is about our street, not Wall Street. And a private bank is about making profits for the bank and its executives and stockholders and its commodes and investing in things like Wells Fargo does for private prisons. A D.C. public bank means that the city revenues go into our own public bank to work for all of the people of the city, like the D.C. sales taxes we pay, like our property taxes, which right now get deposited directly into Wells Fargo.
Hmm.
You know, does Wells Fargo really care about the future of black youth in D.C.? Somehow I don't think so. A couple more things. A D.C. public bank is about making affordable loans together with local banks, like industrial banks, to help our city thrive. And we have four areas for the D.C. public bank to make loans. One is investing in affordable housing. Second is supporting local small businesses. Third is promoting a livable, sustainable city for all of us. And in all of this, four is to create local good-paying jobs.
Okay. And how would it operate differently from a privately owned? Well, you've kind of talked about that in terms of the profits in a private bank versus the money being returned to the public. But would a public bank have the same kind of protections or insured deposits that a private bank has?
It will have the backing of the city behind it. And we've been looking into whether it will have the federal insurance. Probably so, but that is something that we will be looking into.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to just say that we will still need community banks and credit unions where people can do their personal banking, because the public bank is not somewhere where you and I can come and deposit our paycheck. It's for the city funds to be deposited. And, you know, we'd even like to see banks in our post offices. There's the whole movement for banks to be in post offices for people who are unbanked today. So there's a range of things that we need to create our banking system. Public banking is one important piece of it.
Okay. And so what stage are you at right now in terms of creating the bank or exploring the proposal for it?
Well, you know, we have a pretty good idea of how the public bank would work, because in North Dakota, of all places, they've had a public bank since 1919, ever since the farmers got really fed up with the banks foreclosing on their farms, and they organized to take over the state government, which they did, and then they created a public bank. It's one of the most empowering stories I know here in the United States. North Dakota, you know?
Right.
But we still need a feasibility study to look into many of the technical details that will be specific to D.C. So we're pursuing how to get funding for that. We think it's better to do that independently than through the city government. And then it's the city council that's going to have to vote to make the public bank a reality. And for that, we need to build a tsunami of public support.
Okay. So tell me about the event, I guess it's next week, and how people can connect with you.
Sure. So we're very excited about the public forum we've put together. It is, as Simone said, next Wednesday evening, 7 p.m. at the Goethe Institute, which is a gallery place in Chinatown. Just Google for the correct address. It's called Public Dollars, Public Bank in D.C., Building Our Future. And we'll be talking about why public banking is a key to a healthy and just economy and why it makes sense for D.C. We have a really exciting lineup of speakers. Jessica Gordon-Nemhart is chair of One, you know her, of One D.C. And, you know, she's written a fantastic book, Collective Courage, about the history of the African-American cooperative movement, including right here in D.C. I've read every page. I recommend it to people. The second speaker is Harold Meyerson, the Democratic Socialist who writes op-eds for the Washington Post. The third is Nomi Prinz, who left Wall Street and now speaks out for Main Street. She's very compelling. And then we have Gaurav Purovitz, who's nationally known for his writing and speaking about creating a new economic system. He'll be talking about how public banking fits into the larger picture of a new economic system. And finally, we have Professor Gerscher, who's coming all the way from Germany, to tell us about the thriving public banks in Germany. Wow. So we think it's a really exciting lineup.
Wow, that's you have a lot of heavy hitters on that panel.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. So, okay, we know about the event, and that's next Wednesday, 7 p.m. at the Goethe Institute in Chinatown here in D.C. And how else can people be involved and connect with you?
Sure. First of all, to get more information, they can go to our website, which is dcpublicbanking.org. And, of course, they can RSVP for the event next Wednesday on the website as well. And so the first thing is to come to the forum. I think people are going to really come away psyched about the idea of a public bank. The second thing is to sign our petition to the mayor and the city council telling them to create a public bank for D.C. And again, the petition is on our website, dcpublicbanking.org. And we need thousands of signatures from every ward to make the city council realize we mean business. Just watch what just happened with the Exelon-Pepco merger. We know we need public power to make something like this happen. And so we need people not only to sign, but to get their friends and neighbors to sign. And the third thing is for people to talk to their friends and neighbors, to tell them that public banking means our street, not Wall Street. No more having our tax dollars deposited in Wall Street banks like Wells Fargo. And again, urge your friends and neighbors to sign the petition for a public bank at dcpublicbanking.org. And we'd love to have you volunteer as well. You can do that on our website.
Okay. I've been speaking to Ruth Kaplan and Kimon Freeman on this special focus on economics and activism today. Thank you, Ruth.
Thanks so much, Esther.
And thank you, Kimon.
Thank you.
But you can continue and stay here in the studio with me for the next segment if you like. And I also want to remind listeners to go to the phone and be an economic activist for Jazz and Justice Radio during this fall membership drive, 202-588-0893, or pledge online at WPFW.org. I also want to thank Bridget Roussan. Bridget is such a wonderful activist and so committed and so just busy and sincere, and we love her, and we thank her so much for her generous donation. I wish I had a bell, even though she's not a new member, but thank you, because I want you to join Bridget of Northeast DC and John of White Plains, Maryland. Where's Virginia? I get a lot of calls from Virginia every week. I need Virginia in the house. I need you to join DC and Maryland, and you know, even if you are from D.C. in Maryland, you know you can call too and represent wherever you're from. Silver Spring, Bowie, Hyattsville, I need you to call. And also, I get a lot of calls from Arlington, Alexandria. I need you to call right here in D.C., you know, northwest, northeast, southeast, southwest, wherever you are, 202-588-9739, or you can go online to wpfw.org. We will be right back.
Make money. Money don't change we are money changer. But if you're this, we are danger. We work hard for the paper, cause we want big fun, and we want skyscraper. Get out, don't bow. Trust in our Father God and walk on your way up it. Hey, no sell your soul, we change and chill up it. Yes, yeah, man, I roll in a one car, well flashing. Ooh, enough bow, long time for us to share. Now we're type and such chase like mama lashing. Love people, things that they rare, them blood lashing. But my dream come true, so me return, we happy. Money don't change, we are money changer. If you're this, we are danger. We work hard for me paper, cause we want big fun, and we want skyscraper. No girl can't change me. Me a girl changer. Girls, no flight,
and welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Averam, here with writer, activist, and visionary Kimon Freeman on this special show talking about activism and economics. And it is the third Thursday of the month, and On the Ground listeners know that on that day, we devote time to discuss fascism and pre-fascism. Our touchstone is the statement by 1960s revolutionary George Jackson, who defined fascism as the complete control of the state by monopoly capital. He said that fascism is the last stage of capitalism in the heart of the U.S. imperial center, where the relationship between the state and corporation becomes indiscernible. Joining me for this segment is John Jeter, former Washington Post reporter, Facebook iconoclast, and author of the book Flat Broke in the Free Market. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Esther. I love that Facebook iconoclast.
Okay, yeah, it's my own creation. So, John, this morning we're talking about economics and activism in these days after the Justice or Else March, when there was a call for economic action, a corporate boycott. And then on Tuesday night's debate, economics was again at the heart of the discussion, largely because of Bernie Sanders and his campaign, talking about how politics is funded, how our economy is run by corporations. So, I mean, from where you sit, do you think that there's a growing consciousness or more momentum for countering the corporate control of government and the economy?
I think there's a growing desperation. I think, but I don't think there's any organized response. And I think that is alarming, because I do think we're confronted with a very, very real, perhaps even unprecedented crisis, both economic and political in this country. And unfortunately, the last 40 years in this country has been devoted to dividing the progressive elements in this country, the most progressive elements in this country, beginning, of course, with African Americans, and then African American political identity, which has really influenced every effective political movement in this country going back to the end of the Civil War.
Well, you know, it sounds like you're like in Starbucks or something. Like we can hear the bus and we can hear the trolley, you know. No, I know you're in San Francisco.
I am, yes.
And I'm just joking. I don't really hear the trolley, but
okay.
It does sound like you're in the Starbucks though. But a New York Times report that we mentioned earlier on the show talks about a mere 158 American households, comprising nearly half of all the money donated to the 2016 presidential campaign so far. And the donors are disproportionately white, male, old, and very wealthy. And in total, these families account for roughly $176 million in political spending, and it's not even 2016 yet. I mean, from where you sit, is this just proof that Citizens United has transformed us into an oligarchy? And I'm just kind of wondering, you know, what is the difference really on the ground between an oligarchy and, like, pre-fascism?
Well, let me answer the first question first. I think Citizens United was the piece de resistance to, as I mentioned before, basically a movement that started in 1975 with the bankers, the oligarchs, take over New York City's finances. And it's been very clear. I mean, they have whittled away very methodically at the progressive movement, and particularly at all of the on the ladder by which black people have used to pull themselves up, meaning education, labor unions, the family, the black family, understand what's happened with that, civil service, public sector jobs. And this has really started, you know, resulted in this isolation of this black political identity. And you know, historically in this country, without African Americans exerting some real influence on the political system, we've sort of been lost in the wilderness. You know, you've seen, you know, what happened during the New Deal when we had a real coalition come together, particularly in organizing in the labor movement. That was, you know, very much integrated. And you've seen since 1975, the oligarchs have really whittled away, sort of separated blacks from this political coalition. And Citizens United was the peace day resistance. And whether or not, now this, you know, this is not, this is bad, but it's not necessarily the end of everything. I mean, this is what happened again in 1933. There was a movement that came out of nowhere to fashion the New Deal, as imperfect as that was, you know. And so there's still hope, but right now, I mean, we're so sort of, you know, it's really like this country has entered into this, walked into this Tower of Babel over the last 40 years, and we've emerged on the other side speaking completely different languages. And so, you know, the most progressive elements in our society are invisible and isolated.
Okay. You're kind of fading in and out, so I'm not sure what that is, but stay close to your phone. And are you still there? Because it sounded like it went. Oh, you are there?
I am here.
Okay. So it's interesting you brought up the analogy of the New Deal in the 1930s because, you know, yesterday you made a post on Facebook and, you know, asked for people to respond. You said, with our antagonism of non-white people at home and abroad, remember that the Nazis considered Jews non-white, our violent campaign to dominate the world through the theft of resources and our partnership with similarly racist, murderous kleptocracies, Saudi Arabia, UK, France, oligarchs in Colombia, Venezuela, and Honduras, and of course Israel, has the U.S. in 2015 become Nazi Germany in 1935, and we simply haven't noticed it. So this was a very provocative post. And so what was your takeaway after receiving so many responses?
I learned a lot from that post. My takeaway was that we have, you know, not exactly, obviously, but that the elements that made Nazi Germany, you know, are very present here today, and that there are some very real similarities between what's going on in 2015 in the United States and what's going on in Nazi Germany in 1935. And it all is predicated upon austerity here on the ground, this system of starving the people of resources. And that's sort of the predicate for both political economies.
You know, when I started this series, you know, I've talked to a number of scholars and authors like yourself, and one of the things that Gerald Horn was saying is that, you know, who's written about fascism, you know, in terms of books and articles, that, you know, to really talk about fascism, that it would require a whole different set of circumstances. For example, he said he would always say, well, you couldn't even have this conversation on the radio. So we start looking at the conditions for pre-fascism, which is, I suppose, what you're talking about. And I have to say also that there's a series that comes on every now and then on the History Channel. It's called Rise of the Reich, you know, or it says like Third Reich, the rise, and then the fall. And the one that is about the rise, the first part of it, it is eerie how much in that piece it reminds you of like what's happening here in terms of when you hear even presidential candidates speak in the way they do with such a dismissive, you know, racist language about, you know, groups of people, and just even the rhetoric about the unemployed or the imprisoned. you know, it's eerie. So it's something I would recommend to people if they have a chance to see it. But one response to you noted Sheldon Wolin's theory of inverted totalitarianism. And I think that they were quoting a piece written by Chalmers Johnson. And Johnson reduced Wolin's very complex argument to very bare bones and said, and he wrote this, "Since the Depression, the twin forces of managed democracy and superpower have opened the way for something new under the sun, inverted totalitarianism, a form every bit as totalistic as the classical version, but one based on internalized co-optation, the appearance of freedom, political disengagement rather than mass mobilization, and relying more on private media than on public agencies to disseminate propaganda that reinforces the official version of events. It is inverted because it does not require the use of coercion, police power, and a messianic ideology as in the Nazi, fascist, Stalinist versions, although note that in the United States has the highest percentage of its citizens in prison." At the time he wrote this, 751 per 100,000 people of any nation on earth. According to Wolin, inverted totalitarianism has emerged imperceptibly, premeditatedly, and in seeming unbroken continuity with the nation's political traditions. The genius of our inverted totalitarian system lies in wielding total power without appearing to, without establishing concentration camps or enforcing ideological uniformity or forcibly suppressing dissident elements so long as they remain ineffectual. I thought that was really deep. So what was your reaction? Yeah. What was your action to reading that?
Well, I let me take it back to what you said about what Gerald, Professor Horn has said. Far be it for me to contradict that brother. He is brilliant. But I do think that perhaps his definition of fascism or pre-fascism might be a little rich. I think all of these fascist systems are systems in which monopoly capital is the dominant influence, is how I would define it. And I think they all have very distinct characteristics. And I think the one that maybe is most distinct here in the United States, as opposed to, say, Nazi Germany, even I would say, you know, apartheid South Africa, the Perón regime in Argentina, which is very different from what we find anywhere else, is, but here I think what you find is that there is a there is a premium put on this sort of public dissemination of ideas of ideas that are hostile to the truth. In other words, what I mean by that is here I think you have, under the guise of democracy and a free media, you have just the opposite. And so, you know, you can have this conversation on the radio, but of course it's marginalized. You can't have this conversation on CNN, on primetime, or MSNBC, or Fox, or any other of the prime, of the mainstream media. So I do think there's, I think we have a very unique model for fascism here. It's just not like what we've seen in other countries. And so I think that's kind of maybe where I would differ with Professor Horn just a little bit.
Okay. You know, Kimon Freeman is still here in the studio with me. He's a local writer, thinker, activist, and visionary, founder of a progressive radio station here in D.C. And he's been scrolling through his tablet there furiously as we've been talking, and he found a quote from like the 1800s or something. Why don't you read that, Kimon?
This is from Abraham Lincoln. "I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. Corporations have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed." President Abraham Lincoln, November 21st, 1864.
Wow. So the discussion we're having today, people have been having it for a long time, and I suppose that as time has gone on, the conversation and the reality has morphed. It stayed the same, but it's morphed and become perhaps even more urgent for us here in 2015. So I am almost out of time, and I do you have any final thoughts, John? I'm just like right out of time.
I have one thought, Esther, that I think is important. And I don't have it's really a question. I don't have the answer to it. I think it's maybe there is no answer to it right now, but I'm curious to see what develops. You know, what's the Chinese curse? You live in interesting times. I think that's exactly where we are now, even though they're not good times necessarily. But the one, you know, we were talking about sort of the different models for fascism. The one thing that really interests me is the role that technology is going to play. In the Washington Post yesterday, there was a story, I think on the front page, about an app that's being used by retailers in Georgetown to identify mostly black customers who they suspect are guilty of some crime. It didn't really say whether or not they were or not, but they're using this app to sort of really racial profile.
Right, I saw that.
I find this extraordinary, the idea of technology that really sort of returns us to this very primitive, almost feudal state of consciousness and being. I mean, this is not technology that's used to unite us or for progress or for peace. It's used for just the opposite. I mean, you could say the same thing for the technology that enables Uber. You know, Uber is rent-seeking. It's exploitative. It basically takes money from the consumer and most of all from the taxi drivers, working-class people, and distributes it upwards. And so I think, you know, again, talking about the sort of different models for fascism, I think it's going to be really interesting, perhaps not good, perhaps not positive, but really interesting to see going forward the role that technology plays in this encroaching, creeping model of American fascism and just sort of, you know, how much ground we're going to have to make up when it's all said and done.
Wow. Well, thank you for that closing remark. That gives me something to think about. It gives us something, all of us, something to think about. And as we think about this discussion that we're able to have here, free, on unbought, unbossed, public-owned media, I want you to think about that as you go to the phone or go to your computer and support our fall membership drive. You know, be supporters of activism and economics, which we're talking about today. Call 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or pledge online at wpfw.org. I want you to join Bridgette, who joined, and thank you again, Bridgette. I want you to pledge, and also join John from Maryland. And, you know, we have exceeded our goal for the day, but it's not too late. You can still call in and raise your voice with us. Okay, so that will do it for us on today's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avarim, and I want to give a special thanks to my guests, John Jeter, Kimon Freeman, and Ruth Kaplan. And thanks to Chantel James and DJ Waheed for contributing to today's show. And thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can keep calling 202-588-9739 or go to wpfw.org. And there's a donation button on the upper left corner of the homepage that says Donate Now. All donations until the top of the hour will definitely help On the Ground meet its goal. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Kimon is here, so I'll add, do something. Peace. Thank you.